Looking for a geek podcast? We're the Fellowship of the Geeks. We talk about comics, movies, TV, books, games, pretty much whatever gets our attention. And our attention is kind of all over the place. And full disclosure, we get a little ranty at times. Well, a lot of times. Pretty much all the time. But anyway, come check out the Fellowship of the Geeks podcast. You can find us wherever you normally get your podcasts.
It's time to feel the rage. Join us on Film Rage, where we talk movies, current releases, coming attractions, streaming, and classic films as well. Directors and actors, beware, as you cannot hide from the rage. My name is Bryce, and I'm part of the Film Rage crew, which also includes Jim.
Hey, hey.
And Murray.
Yo.
Why is it you always talk all the time? I can't understand why
this voice is so... This is the Merman, the voice of reason. These two can't agree on anything most of the time. Some movies are Mondo, some are just... Every week, something is going to make us rage. Join us every Wednesday. And
feel the rage.
Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12. Just to keep us warm. In 5 minutes, it'll be the 21st of April. 100 years ago, on the 21st of April, out on the waters around Spivey Point, a small clipper ship drew toward land. Suddenly, out of the night, the fog rolled in. For a moment, they could see nothing, not a foot ahead of them. And then they saw a light. My God, it was a fire burning on the shore, strong enough to penetrate swirling mist. They steered a course toward the light, but it was a campfire like this one. The ship crashed against the rocks. The hull sheared in two. The mast snapped like a twig, and the wreckage sank with all the men aboard. And at the bottom of the sea lay the Elizabeth Dane with her crew, their lungs filled with salt water, their eyes open and staring into the darkness. And above, as suddenly as it had come, the fog lifted, receded back across the ocean, and never came again. But it is told by the fishermen and their fathers and grandfathers that when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea, out in the water by Spivey Point, will rise up and search for the campfire that led them to their dark and icy death. 12 o'clock. The 21st of April.
Thank you. This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to Camp Shifty Lake, my friends, my counselors. We put the kids to sleep, and we have a tradition here on the night of Halloween to tell creepy stories under the moonlit sky, in front of the fire, and I'd really like to get some originality, some really great creepy stories from all of you. Let's really get in the spirit of Halloween, get a chill down our spines. Not be able to sleep tonight because we creeped each other out. I know Sam and Stormy have got one.
All right, I have a story. This happened to my sister's roommate's cousin, Sally, a few years ago. One summer, Sally heard that someone was digging up graves in her hometown in Texas.
That sounds like Ed Gein.
So she and three of her friends decided to make a trip down to make sure everything was all right. As they drove down, the landscape turned from a city to suburban ranch houses to acres and acres of nothing. The open windows let in a subtle stench of beef slaughterhouses that stuck in Sally's nose. Once they reached the outer limits of the town, they stopped at the first gas station they saw to fill up. The building, supported by moldy beams, held an old proprietor. "Sorry, no gas. Shipment won't be here for days." Of course, Sally started to feel uneasy. The look of the dilapidated station reminded her of the local lore of the Sawyer family. The Sawyers were a reclusive family living in an old abandoned farmhouse. They weren't like any other family in the area, and the townsfolk always whispered about the stuff they got up to in that old farmhouse. Incest, murder, cannibalism. Real scary stories that would make any sane person stay far, far away from that old farmhouse. Well, being out of gas with nothing to do and hearing such crazy rumors, Sally and her friends did what teenagers do best and decided to go explore the old farmhouse for themselves. Maybe there'd be a can of gasoline or a phone to call for help. Maybe.
As the sun dipped below the horizon, casting long, haunting shadows, they approached the Sawyer farmhouse and ventured inside. Cobwebs clung to every corner, and there was a heavy smell of decay in the thick, moist air. Old photographs watched them as they stepped further into a place they had no right to be. Each step they took was heavier than the last, but the distant hum of a gas-powered generator sounded like their ticket out of there. The group of friends wandered the rooms until they reached a hallway, the lamps on the walls glinting off of a large metal door out of place in the wooden brick home. The friends stopped, looking at each other, silently asking, "Should we turn back?" Suddenly, the silence was shattered by a chilling sound, the guttural growl of a chainsaw, the roar reverberating through the halls of the farmhouse. The metal door was violently pulled open, and Leatherface, the youngest of the Sawyer brothers, emerged from the darkness. His face was hidden behind a mask crafted from another man's face. Sally's friend Kirk was closest. She blinked, and the blade of the chainsaw swung up in an arc, only to come back down. Kirk's neck was in the way.
Jesus!
Sally blinked away a spray of blood. Run, run, run. Sally made it back through the house and out the front door. That's when she heard the screams of her friends. The deafening roar of the chainsaw. The monster was in the house. Her friends were in the house. And she was outside. Alone.
Huddled in the dirt, Sally was still. The screams told a story. Kirk's girlfriend Pam's screams were unmistakable. They came from everywhere as Pam led Leatherface to the basement. She ran as fast as she could, but was suddenly plucked from her feet, much like a child plucks a tiny bug from the ground below. Leatherface's grip crushed her small ribcage as she flailed her arms and kicked at him. His clammy hands only gripped tighter. And then, the pain. Leatherface set her onto a hook meant for a pig carcass. Razor sharp, it slipped easily through flesh, muscle, bone, lung. Still, she screamed. Sally didn't know how many minutes or how many hours she sat huddled near the front door of the house, afraid to leave, afraid to stay. The screams had died down, she thought. A twig snapped nearby and shot a current down her spine. He's here. Sally? Her relief to hear her friend Jerry's voice nearly took her breath away. He crouched and approached her, holding out his hand. Sally looked at him and thought this may be the last chance she had to tell him how she felt. She had loved him this whole time. Did he even know? We've got to go back, Sally, he shouted in a whisper. Spittle glistened on his chin. Sally! Sally found herself back inside the house, the only light coming from the heavily shaded lamps. They cast a dim yellow hue on everything. Outside was pure darkness, and the stars glowed in the sky with no city for miles and miles in every direction. They were alone. No one knew where they were. Sally tried to find reason behind their decisions. Why did we do this?
They entered the living room, light on their feet. Sally couldn't quite understand what she was seeing, though. Animal bones littered the floor, but some were too large, too human. The furniture was covered in a layer of dirt and pale debris she couldn't identify. The air was still, the smell of burning hair. The carpet squelched under their feet as they continued through the room, slow enough their limbs shook. Sally could only think of the masked man. She had forgotten completely about the rest of the Sawyer family as they quietly trespassed. That's when they both saw it in the corner of the room. The mummified corpse of a man, gray and shriveled, sat perched on a rocking chair. Thin wisps of hair still clung to the skin. They inched closer, and a strong smell of urine broke through, and a noise. Sally thought it was her imagination, but she held her breath. A grumbling whistle, the wisps of hair drifting to and fro. It was alive. Their trance was broken by the sound of boots bounding toward them. Jerry grabbed Sally's arm and tugged her away with a force that pulled her to her knees. As she looked up, she saw him and screamed. Leatherface had Jerry by the neck with a grip so tight his fingers interlaced. Jerry's feet left the floor. Sally noticed that Jerry had a weapon and was hitting the masked man with what looked like a metal pipe. Leatherface had a weapon too. A hammer occupied his other hand. He lifted it up and gave one clean drop to the top of Jerry's skull. Sally watched as Jerry's body dropped to the floor, legs still twitching. I love you, Jerry, she thought. Get out. She crawled backwards as Leatherface lunged toward her. He grabbed at her bare legs as she kicked him away. She scooted right into the legs of the mummified man and screamed. In a moment, Leatherface had her by the hair and his fist connected with her cheek like a brick, turning her vision to black.
Sally woke up, although she didn't want to. Her body was stiff, and she realized she was bound to a chair with hemp rope that splintered as she moved her wrists beneath it. She was sat at the head of a long wooden table, damp with rot. The mummified man was sitting at the opposite end, the two eldest Sawyer brothers to the left and Leatherface alone on the right. Sally's vision cleared. What she thought was blood on Leatherface's mask was actually women's makeup. The blue eyeshadow and red lipstick smothered on the white of the mask was grotesque. The men stared back at her, so she averted her eyes to the table. She noticed a plate of food in front of her that turned her stomach. Then it happened, a cacophony of men's voices taunting her and screaming profane things I won't repeat. Leatherface got up and stood behind the mummified corpse, who they called Grandpa, and pushed him over in his wicker wheelchair. Let him suck her, Bubba! Was Bubba Leatherface's real name? Sally thought. They were next to her now, and a knife reappeared in Leatherface's hand. His hand held down Sally's as she pleaded for him to stop. No, no, no. Pressure, and then a searing pain as the knife cut the soft flesh of her finger. Leatherface let out a grunt of pleasure from beneath his skin mask. The warm blood ran from her finger with a butcher's precision. Leatherface made another cut to the rope that bound her bleeding hand. He lifted her finger in front of Grandpa's shriveled face. She couldn't fight it. Her bleeding finger went into Grandpa's mouth, the blood enlivening him. He sucked with such force that Sally was sure she'd have no skin left. Sally didn't know if he ever stopped. All she could do was scream. She didn't remember losing time and everything going dark. Sally thought this must be a nightmare. Please be a nightmare.
Finally, the Sawyers decided they were tired of her yapping and that it was time for her to meet the same fate as her friends. It would be their grandpa's honor to give her the final blow to end her life. They pulled her out of her chair and bent her over a steel bucket to collect the blood splatter before handing the hammer to Grandpa. But, like a gift from above, the old man's grip was too weak to hold a tool in his hand. Sally took this distraction to her advantage and ran out of the room, jumping through a window to get outside, where she heard the engine of an old truck coming down the road. As Leatherface sped after her, she ran as fast as her legs could carry her until she finally reached her life raft. Sally was the only one to make it out of the house alive. Covered in blood, sweat, and dirt, she hopped into the back of a truck and rode out of that town, never looking back. The sound of the chainsaw echoing in the distance, or so she claims. And sometimes, when she's alone at night, she says that she can still hear it. The lingering hum of the chainsaw and the screams of her friends who died in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Maybe some places are best left unexplored. If you ever find yourself alone in the heart of Texas, beware the night, beware the dark, and beware the chainsaw bite.
Wait, that's a movie.
Without a doubt, that may have been the greatest story that's ever been told.
I'm not sleeping tonight.
I don't want to scare anyone. But I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason. His body was never recovered from the lake after he drowned. And if you listen to the old timers in town, they'll tell you he's still out there. Some sort of demented creature. Surviving in the wilderness. Full grown by now. Stalking. Stealing what he needs. Living off wild animals and vegetation. Some folks claim they've even seen him. Right in this area. The girl who survived that night at Camp Blood, that Friday the 13th, she claimed she saw him. She disappeared 2 months later. Vanished. Blood was everywhere. No one knows what happened to her. Legend has it that Jason saw his mother beheaded that night, that he took his revenge. A revenge that he'll continue to seek if anyone ever enters his wilderness again. And by now, I guess you all know, we're the first to return here. 5 years, 5 long years he's been dormant. And he's hungry. Jason's out there. Watching. Always on the prowl for intruders. Waiting to kill. Waiting to devour. Thirsty for young blood.
Mike, I have a scary story for you guys. I know, right? And like any good scary story, this one starts with a lawyer. There's a lawyer riding through the countryside, heading to visit a foreign nobleman. This is oldie times, so he's riding in a carriage. There's other people in the carriage. They're kind of funny and strange. And he gets to the small town where the nobleman's castle is, and everybody's got everything all locked up, and they're being real tight-lipped and not talking about stuff. Given some tribulations, the lawyer gets to this castle up in the mountains in the middle of nowhere in Eastern Europe because his job is he's got a real estate deal for the nobleman. He's going to sell him some property. A few things go down. Yeah. The castle is a strange place. There might be an armadillo or two involved. not sure why, but
The snakes just look scary.
They do. They're creepy as hell.
They are.
Especially when they're... Never mind.
They're like rats in armor.
They are like rats.
Little mites.
A very, very strange sweater that that particular possum is wearing. But anyway. So, lawyer and nobleman pack up some stuff because nobleman's moving to London, which is where the lawyer's from. They get on a boat to sail, and it's a bit of a rough trip. I think there might have been a movie about that trip.
Mm. How rough was it?
Oh, it was so rough.
It was too rough to feed them.
It was rougher than rough.
Ooh.
Rough.
It was as rough as a crowd of dogs.
You let him out.
Anyway. Anyway, so at this point in the story, we cut to a nice little home in London where we meet a couple of young ladies. We're going to call the first one OG Final Girl, and we're going to call the other one her slutty friend.
Her slutty friend. Because everyone needs a slutty friend.
Well, because... She's got more than one boyfriend. We'll put it that way. And she gets around. She's a social butterfly. There's a lot of euphemism.
Oh, is that what they call them?
Going on in here. Oh man. We could go on for hours
she
just on that alone.
She got more than her wings in the air.
She does indeed. And of course these two sweet innocent young ladies are surrounded Final Girl and her slutty friend. They've got the social circle thing going on. They are surrounded by a bunch of old white guys who are just way too interested in their business. Okay. And strange things. I mean, it doesn't take long for strange things to start happening. This is kind of a scary story, after all.
This is already sounding bad. Old white guys in a circle with two girls, and things are about to get strange. Is this a PG story you're telling?
We've all seen a lot of movies like that. I'm just saying.
Sounds like a normal day on Facebook.
Yeah. Right. Well, a little bit. A little bit. I mean, not saying anything about the slutty friend or nothing, but she actually starts to get sick. and her illness progresses pretty quickly to the point where she dies. Early in the story.
Like, in the same night she gets sick and dies?
Within a few days.
Okay.
And some of the old white guys are a little suspicious, and so they call in an old teacher and...
Another white guy?
Oh, totally.
Did he join the circle?
He joins the circle, at least for purposes of our story. And he starts nosing around in the young lady business. And decides, oh man, this is bad. We got us a big problem here. And nobody believes him because they think he's crazy. And then all of a sudden in this social circle, a new social player shows up. A new old white guy who happens to be the nobleman that we were talking about earlier. The lawyer's still around too, but he's not noble and he's also not at all well. He's got issues now, but he's still around in the background. So the professor decides it's time to lock all this down. Okay, bad things are happening. We need a lockdown here. There's a lot of locking of doors. There's a lot of bad air fresheners filling the air with lots and lots of stuff. Lots of things that drive off evil spirits. Because, you know, this
is... Like sage?
There's a lot of garlic involved. We'll put it that way.
Oh, okay. They're Italian.
A lot of garlic. I'm not saying that there's not also tomatoes. I'm not saying one way or the other. The nobleman, as soon as he meets our final girl, he starts to fixate on her pretty hard. It's downright creepy. I mean, he's not that super old looking a guy.
Like stalker?
Kind of like stalker, yeah. That sort of whole thing gets weird for a little while. And then all of a sudden, final girl starts to get a little sick. By this time, the professor's like, okay, yeah, this is really, really bad. We know what this is. Now we need to find the source. He spends pretty much the whole rest of the movie trying to find the source.
What's all the tomatoes and garlic?
Both socially and geographically.
Tell me more about Marianne.
But this story's all about Ginger. Come on now.
Sorry.
The slutty friend?
The slutty friend is, and it's funny. Actually, it's funny you should mention that. The slutty friend is kind of the ginger to the final girl's Marianne. There is kind of that type of relationship there. There's a Gilligan in the story, but it's, and it might very well be the lawyer. But we'll, I guess we'll figure that out as we go. Right, and so along the way, the professor is kind of angling around, and he starts to suspect the foreign nobleman. Yeah, and it also doesn't help that whoever our bad guy is clearly has issues with figuring out that he shouldn't be eating people in his own backyard.
Eating people with tomatoes and garlic.
Used to, well, how you prepare it? But, I mean, you know, it's all relative, right?
We never claimed them to be bright.
No, no, quite the contrary. It's very dark around this guy a lot. But anyway. Lots of tuxedos and shit. But anyway.
You know, I'm thinking Hannibal Lecter and Wild Bill. Was his name Bill?
Buffalo Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, Buffalo Bill.
Was there a tuxedo in this?
Right. Yeah. Was it made of skin?
If it was an animal, it could be Tennessee tuxedo.
Tennessee, yeah. You know? Could be, or it could be that little penguin in the Bugs Bunny cartoon. That was cool, too.
It was Armadillo, guys. That's why he's not around.
You know, he could
but
be
we
right.
Digress.
When we never do that. What are you talking about? So, yeah, so things are starting to come to a head at this point. Final girl's getting sicker. Nobleman's starting to feel the pressure from the professor, because the professor has actually figured it out. And the lawyer occasionally pops up, because he actually breaks out of the asylum they locked him in, and gets in the way like a lot of fictional lackeys do from time to time. But eventually, our story does have sort of a happy ending. I mean, as much as a bunch of old white guys and a hammer and a stake can provide. But yeah, with the liberal application of some percussive remedy, our final girl gets saved in the end after all. And several people in the story live happily ever after. Maybe not everybody.
What was making him sick?
It was a specific form of anemia.
Mm-hmm.
The bone marrow just couldn't keep up.
But I'm once, doing my best, Captain.
But once the nobleman goes away, strangely enough, things get better.
Yay.
Until the sequel comes along anyway, of course.
Of course.
Or the remake. Or the other remake. Or the prequel. Or the thing about the boat trip, like I just talked about before.
Very nice.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Fucking white people.
Oh my god. Could that be more dripping with cheese? What am I, living in Holland right now?
My Uncle Roger said that he once saw an albino polar bear.
Really? Polar bears are white. How would he know if it's an albino?
This one was black.
Did you ever think maybe it was just a black bear?
Whatevs.
Hey, Jim, do you got one?
Gather closely, my friends, and let the crackling campfire illuminate the shadows as I spin a chilling tale of vampiric secrets and unlikely friendships. In the frosty heart of winter, in a town blanketed by eternal snow, there lived a young boy named Oscar. Oscar was an unassuming soul, finding solace in the quiet solitude of the snow-laden landscape and the distant howls of wolves echoing through the night.
Oh. Oh.
One bone-chilling evening, as the moon hung low and the stars peeked through the thick clouds, Oscar met a peculiar companion unlike any other. Their name was Ellie, a mysterious figure who seemed to appear out of thin air. Their eyes as dark as night itself. Their skin as pale as snow.
How pale is that snow?
As days turned into weeks, Oscar and Ellie formed an inexplicable bond, their friendship blossoming in the hushed whispers of the night. Little did Oscar know, Ellie harbored a dark secret.
No.
One that would send shivers down the bravest spines. They were a vampire. Cursed to roam the night. Their hunger for blood insatiable and unyielding. In the heart of winter, a series of gruesome murders began to plague the town. Mutilated bodies were discovered, their lifeless eyes wide with terror.
So awful.
sending ripples of fear through the community. The townsfolk whispered of a malevolent spirit, a creature of the night, that preyed on the innocent and guilty alike. The air was thick with dread, and the scent of fear hung heavy.
Chilling.
Unbeknownst to the townsfolk, Ellie was the source of these horrors.
No.
Ellie's thirst for blood drove them to commit unspeakable acts.
Unspeakable.
Leaving a trail of death in their wake. Yet, in Oscar's eyes, Ellie was more than their monstrous nature. Ellie was his confidant, his companion, and he was willing to overlook their dark cravings for the warmth of their friendship. As the winter nights grew longer, the truth began to unravel. Oscar, despite his innocence, started to comprehend the depth of Ellie's darkness.
No.
He witnessed their feeding, their fangs sinking into the fragile flesh of their victims.
Oh my God.
Their eyes glinting with a hunger both primal and terrifying.
What is this terror?
Yet he remained steadfast in his loyalty, torn between the horror of their actions and the compassion he felt for his friend. Amidst the chaos and fear, a group of townsfolk embarked on a mission to unmask the creature responsible for the brutal murders. They armed themselves with stakes, holy symbols, and torches, ready to confront the evil that lurked in the night. One fateful evening, as the northern lights danced across the sky in a ghostly display, the townsfolk cornered Ellie and Oscar in an abandoned house. The air crackled with tension, the atmosphere heavy with the scent of fear. Oscar, torn between his loyalty to Ellie and his fear of the townsfolk, stood at the crossroads of his destiny. In the chilling silence, Ellie confessed their sins, with eyes pleading for understanding. Oscar, his heart heavy with sorrow, embraced Ellie, shielding them from the accusing eyes of the mob. In that moment, he made a choice that defied reason and sent shockwaves through the very fabric of the town's reality.
My God!
With a newfound determination, Oscar and Ellie fled into the night, leaving behind the town gripped by fear and uncertainty. Their tale became a whispered legend, a cautionary campfire story shared among the bravest souls, reminding them of the thin line between friendship and monstrosity, between love and darkness.
No.
And so beneath the canopy of stars, Oscar and Ellie boarded a train to parts unknown. Their future in question. But two things are known for sure. Ellie's hunger will never be satisfied.
Blood.
And Oscar will do anything for his dark companion. And with that, the story of Oscar and Ellie echoes through the ages. A haunting reminder that sometimes the most terrifying creatures are not the supernatural beings that haunt your nightmares, but the ones that dwell within the depths of our own hearts. And sometimes, that midnight passenger train that stops at your local station may be transporting more than you bargained for. As the train comes to a halt, a dark, insatiable hunger may step onto the platform. And if this is the case, you better lock up your house, because Ellie may come to your door. And if that is the case, hope does not exist for you. And there will be blood.
Vampires? Vampires aren't real.
That's what you think.
Moon kills, you know. It feeds off the earth. On a night like this, one of us could get up in the middle of the night, grab an axe, and cut somebody's head off. I remember a night like this a few years ago. A guy and a girl went out driving. It was one of their first dates. Started out kind of casual, but they ended up deciding to go park. Not too far from here, as a matter of fact. Well, they're going at it, listening to the radio. All of a sudden, a news bulletin broke in. A dangerous lunatic has escaped from the hospital for the criminally insane at Two Pines.
Oh, come on, Trev.
They described him as a monster, 6.5 feet tall, 260 pounds, with one horrible distinguishing feature.
A sharpened stainless steel hook where his right hand used to be. That was enough for the guy. He slammed the car into gear, floored it, bounced off a tree, didn't stop till they got to the girl's house. Got out of his side, walked around to hers. There, hanging in the door, covered with blood, was a stainless steel hook.
Oh.
The strangest part is that after all these years, after the biggest manhunt in Two Pines history, they never found the killer. Some people say he's still up here in the woods, waiting for the chance to kill again. And I say they're right.
Hey, my dinner!
This is not a bullshit story.
No, you guys, it's true. I heard it before.
Yeah.
I heard it was on a beach.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I heard it happen in a park.
Oh, I heard it, but the guy was missing a foot.
How could the guy have a hook on his foot?
It's dark.
Somebody put a log on that fire.
Fucking campfire smoke's in my face again. It only goes towards the most beautiful.
Gather round and let me tell you about the babe.
What babe?
The babe with the power.
What power?
The power of voodoo.
Voodoo?
Do what?
Shut up and let me tell the story. Gather round the flickering campfire, my friends, and prepare to be transported to a world of chilling intrigue and supernatural terror. This tale is not for the faint of heart, for it delves deep into the labyrinthine depths of fear and fantasy. Let me start this story as all good stories start, with Once Upon a Time. Once upon a time, there lived a young girl named Sarah, a raven-haired teenager who was known for her vivid imagination and her love of stories. One evening, Sarah was lost in her imagination and returned home late to babysit her brother Toby. Sarah could be headstrong and selfish. Finding her favorite childhood teddy bear given to Toby, along with his constant crying, caused her to make a sinister wish.
Goblin King, wherever you may be, take this child of mine far away from me.
As the clock struck midnight, the shadows grew long, and an eerie wind whispered through the trees carrying this dark wish to the malevolent Goblin King, Jareth, the enigmatic figure in her stories. As lightning cracks from the storm outside, the charismatic Goblin King grants Sarah's wish. Toby vanishes, stolen away to the Goblin Kingdom. Jareth, a handsome, suave, soft-spoken man, offers Sarah the fantasy world of her dreams, but her dream has become a nightmare, and she refuses his offer. Jareth's eyes glitter with otherworldly malice, and he offers Sarah one chance to save her baby brother. You have 13 hours to reach the center of my labyrinth, or your baby brother will become one of us forever. In a panic, Sarah ventured into the dark, dead forest, chasing after her stolen sibling. The woods grew darker and more ominous with each step, and strange, otherworldly creatures emerged from the shadows, whispering cryptic warnings into her ears. Go this way, go that way, they say, as she reaches the entrance to the labyrinth, sending Sarah down the wrong path of the eerie maze adorned with dead vines and weathered, cracked stone walls. After encountering Hoggle, an angry dwarf who reluctantly provides her with directions, Sarah continued her harrowing journey, delving deeper into the labyrinth's winding, shadowy corridors. Her path is fraught with treacherous obstacles, from talking door knockers with twisted grins to eerie creatures who sang songs of doom. As the hours ticked away, the labyrinth itself seemed to conspire against her, its shifting walls and deceptive illusions playing tricks on her senses. The Goblin King was a constant, seductive, yet sinister presence, his intentions unclear as he watched Sarah's every move from the shadows with his mismatched eyes gleaming malevolent light. He taunted her with cryptic riddles, testing the limits of her resolve and sanity. The boundaries between dreams and nightmares blurred, and Sarah herself was ensnared in a surreal dance of dread and desire. Sarah encountered the strange, dark denizens of the labyrinth, each more sinister than the last. After falling into a pit lined with the helping hands,
up or down,
who were not helpful at all, the mischievous dwarf Hoggle reappears to help her, only to be an agent of Jareth, sent to delay her quest, putting her even in more peril. On her journey, she encounters a monstrous furry creature with large horns named Ludo, who becomes a faithful ally after she frees him from one of Jareth's terrible traps. After rescuing Sarah from the treacherous fire gang, with their fiery orange fur and detachable limbs, Hoggle is punished, and both fall into the dark, bubbling, flatulent swamp called the Bog of Eternal Stench.
Smells bad,
There, they meet the noble fox knight, Sir Didymus, and his bearded collie steed, Ambrosius. Ludo uses his great power to call upon the stone and rock of the dark swamp. Large boulders rise and appear to help the fearsome creature and his allies escape the deadly clutches of the swamp. As the night wore on and Sarah's grip on sanity slipped away, the memory of her quest is ripped away by a poison peach, reluctantly given to her by Hoggle by the order of the Goblin King.
That's the pits.
Jareth appears in Sarah's dream of a wonderful masquerade ball, dressed in the finest garments, to profess his love to Sarah, only to be rejected once again. Sarah wakes in a junkyard full of tossed away trinkets and forgotten things. There she meets a gnarled hag of a witch carrying a large pack of items on her back, who tries to manipulate and brainwash Sarah. But Sarah's newfound friends come to her aid and remind her of her crucial mission. As the sand slipped through the hourglass, Sarah's desperation grew. She was taunted and tormented, but her love for Toby fueled her determination. In the darkest corner of the labyrinth, she faced her ultimate challenge, a harrowing confrontation with the Goblin King himself, in a room that defied logic or reason.
Don't go in there!
In a climactic battle of wits, magic, and courage, Sarah confronted Jareth in his ancient magical castle at the heart of the labyrinth. The labyrinth's chilling secrets were unveiled, and the fate of her brother hung in the balance. With her love and determination, she managed to outsmart Jareth and rescue her brother by reciting the last lines in the book that she could not remember until this moment.
You have no power over me,
she says defiantly, defeating the clever and enigmatic Goblin King. But the labyrinth was not without its price. It left an indelible mark on Sarah's soul, and she realized that the dark and mysterious creature she encountered would forever be a part of her world. She returned to the human realm, leaving behind the labyrinth, the ancient old forest, and the chilling memory of her harrowing adventure. And to this day, those who venture deep into the woods near Sarah's family home tell tales of an otherworldly maze, an enigmatic Goblin King, and a young girl who once danced with danger in the labyrinth, a place where reality and dreams intertwine, and where the border between the ordinary and the extraordinary blurs. So, my friends, as the campfire burns low and the night grows darker, remember that sometimes the most terrifying stories are the ones that blur the line between reality and the realms of the fantastical, where the goblins and ghouls are all too real, and the labyrinth's treacherous paths may lead you to places you'd never dare to imagine.
Scary.
That was a great story.
You guys ever hear the story of the machete maniac?
Ooh. Well, let's hear it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably too scary for you guys.
No, it's not.
No, come on, Dave. Please tell us the story.
All right, what the hell. This must have been like 15 years ago, you know? We had a kid working at the club named Phil Coletti. And one night, it's a night a lot like tonight, this gorgeous woman comes into the club, asks him if he wants to go out to the jungle. He's like, yeah, why not? So they split. And as they started getting out to the jungle, further and further away from the lights of the club, she starts asking him these questions like, does he believe in the local legends of the island? Voodoo, zombies. He's not too worried about it. He just rolls right over, starts putting the screws to her. And something doesn't feel right to Coletti. But he can't see shit, it's pitch black, so he just keeps banging away. But then boom! A flash of lightning lights up the whole island. And in that one moment, Coletti looks around and sees not only is he out in the middle of that old Mayan cemetery. Not only are all the other guys from the resort standing around watching him, but he sees that he's having sex with a corpse. A cold, white, dirty from the grave dead body. And they say, Phil Coletti calmly walked to the groundskeeper's shack, found a machete, and chopped those staff members into 100 pieces. And they say he took that same machete, chopped his own dick off, and ran screaming into the jungle. Nobody ever saw him after that. But from that point on, Phil Coletti was forever known as Machete Phil.
Are you telling me there's some totally deranged, dickless dude running around out there?
All I'm saying is I don't go into the jungle alone if I can help it. Because you can hear him, and I've heard him crying out, where's my penis? Where's my penis?
Where's my penis?
And that boy was me!
You're an asshole, Putman.
Special thanks to Jim, Mike, Sam, Stormy, and Sean, and of course Val Stepanenko for some reactions. Go check out Film Rage, Real Horror Show, Fellowship of the Geek, and What Does It Matter podcasts. Thank you all for being part of this amazing experiment of Campfire Tales. Maybe we'll do this again sometime. Until then, happy Halloween!
There was a camp not far from here, just across the lake. It was called Camp Blackfoot. No one goes there anymore. Everything burnt down. There's nothing left except the ruins. Now, this camp had a caretaker, a really evil bastard, and his name was Cropsy. Everyone hated Cropsy. For a start, he was a drunk. 2 bottles of whiskey a day, no problem. Like, most of the time, he's somewhere out in space. But if he caught you, look out. Because Cropsy could strip the paint off the walls just by breathing on them. Now, this Cropsy was a sadist. I mean, he got real pleasure out of hurting people, scaring them. And he had these garden shears, you know? The kind with long, thin blades. He carried them all the time, wherever he went. And he had this kind of demonic way of looking at you. One time, this Cropsy really went after this kid from Brooklyn. Followed him around night and day. He made this kid's life living hell. But this time he chose the wrong guy. Because the kid and some of his buddies had planned a little prank that would scare the living shit out of Cropsy. Only problem was, the gag went wrong. The next thing anyone knows, Cropsy's trapped alive and burning in his bunk. They try to get him out, but the fire's so fierce they can't reach him. All they can do is stand outside and listen to him cry out in agony. They say he smashed his way through the bunk room door, just a mass of flames. And as he screamed out, burned alive, he cried out, "I will return! I will have my revenge!" They never found his body. He survived. He lives on whatever he can catch. Eats them raw, alive, no longer human. Right now, he's out there. Watching. Waiting. Don't look. He'll see you. Don't move. He'll hear you. Don't breathe. You're dead!